Good evening. On behalf of the London School of Economics and the Latin American Circle, I would like to welcome you here this evening. It is a great pleasure and honor to have as our last speaker for the year, the distinguished Dr. Oscar Arias, former president of Costa Rica and 1987 Nobel Peace Prize recipient. I want to thank especially LSE students that I've been here this evening, especially in the middle of exams, as I just have taken one myself. And I'd like to leave the floor to Laura Dachner. She's going to introduce the former president. She's a member from Latin CIRC, and she's from Costa Rica as well. Thank you.
Good evening, fellow students, faculty, and guests. I'm pleased to welcome you this evening to the London School of Economics. It is my great honor as a member of the Latin American Circle, and particularly as a Costa Rican citizen, to introduce to you one of the most renowned figures on American, Latin American politics, and also a fellow student of LSE, Dr. Oscar Arias. In 1986, Dr. Arias was elected president of Costa Rica, a position he served until 1990. Pursuing an aggressive anti-militaristic foreign policy, he ended Costa Rican support of the Contras in Nicaragua. Then, in 1987, he met with the assembled presidents of Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and then they pursued the Central American peace process. The resulting plan, which became known as the Arias Peace Initiative, called for an end to outside aid for guerrillas, a ceasefire, continued peace talks, the promotion of democratic freedoms, and a ban on the use of one country as a base for attacks on another. Dr. Arias' effort to stabilize a long volatile region earned him the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. With the proceeds of the prize, he founded the Arias Foundation for Peace and Human Progress in 1988. Today, Dr. Arias continued to seek political rather than military solutions for civil strife. He's a member of the International Network Negotiation, a group of former heads of the states and other dignitaries who offer their services as peacemakers all over the world. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Oscar Arias.
Queridos amigos, I thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. It is always a privilege and an honor to join an intellectual community such as this one in an engaging dialogue. It is my hope that you will bring fresh ideas and innovative thoughts to the issues which we will discuss. As members of one of the most prestigious universities in the world, and representatives of the generation that will next govern our planet, you are faced with great responsibilities. I have no doubts that your education has prepared you to undertake the most difficult of challenges with the hope and understanding that characterizes your generation. Today, I would like to share my thoughts with you on a subject that as a Costa Rican troubles me more than any other, the future of Latin America. I must admit that I am reluctant to make predictions in times as agitated as these. I shall undertake such an endeavor, however, knowing that the factors determining Latin America's destiny have experienced little, if any, change. In the end, understanding these historical components will be the key to opening Latin America's doors toward a brighter future. I have always thought that Latin America's stormy voyage towards modernity would be much less precarious if we put as much energy into learning the lessons our history tried to teach us as we invested in pursuing exotic utopias. We have navigated time and again the same waters, equipped with maps made by others, headed toward a promised land of well-being, and carrying simple explanations and solutions to our chaotic reality. Ours is a reality best manifested in the tormented writings of our literature. Yet, the result has always been the same: accumulated frustrations and unfulfilled hopes, periodically revived by some passing fad. We have refused to listen to the lessons of our history because, unfortunately, that history tells us that there are no easy answers for Latin America. That history, in fact, suggests that our course, littered as it is with the accumulated wrecks of the social and political injustice of prior generations, will make our voyage extraordinarily difficult to navigate. Today, I, as a Latin America, am proud to say that during the last two decades, my region of the world has set forth on a democratic adventure without precedent in our history. This should give us all cause for hope. Nevertheless, it is only natural to wonder about the sustainability and the quality of the democracies that have emerged in Latin America. Although we have regular elections, half of my region's population are living and dying in poverty. 100 million exist in abject poverty and extreme misery. Children of a lesser God, virtually excluded from our political system and condemned to a short and brutish existence, these millions of poverty-stricken humans are a constant reminder that Latin America's fundamental dilemmas are yet to be resolved. Neither globalization, nor economic growth, nor democratic institutions will represent lasting solutions to Latin America if our people do not adopt a new ethical stance and a historical objectivity that we have previously lacked. How much insanity can our societies tolerate? We have known for a long time that Latin America has the worst distribution of wealth in the world. The income gap that exists between rich and poor is by far the widest and the most profound. As Carlos Fuentes has pointed out, 24 individuals in Mexico possess more wealth than 24 million Mexicans. Furthermore, the richest 20% of Brazil's population earn 32 times more than the poorest 20%. This income disparity has turned our political history into a long succession of populist, politically violent, and authoritarian cycles. Latin Americans have only reaped a bitter harvest from this lasting inequity. If we are to rethink our path toward our future, we must be sensitive to the subtleties inherent in development and avoid false dichotomies. The most important issues at which we must be aware concern the role of the state and the free market. The utterly negative view of the state by the proponents of the market, or conversely, of the market by the proponents of state intervention, are equally naive, dangerous, and pointless. There is no doubt that many decades of extensive state intervention in the economy have had positive effects on the growth and modernization of the economy of Latin America. It has also, however, helped to create protected and inefficient manufacturing sectors, corrupt state systems, and an uncontrollable proliferation of interest groups constantly in search of bureaucratic favor. Obviously, we must adjust the role played by the state in Latin America. We must free the private sector from the chains that have condemned it to inefficiency. And we must recognize that it is in our best interest to allow the private sector to undertake many of the productive functions previously monopolized by the state. I am not supporting any particular orthodoxy in stating these truisms. I am simply reflecting upon the domestic reality of most of our countries. It is, however, unreasonable and dangerous to mistake a reform of the state's role with a systematic destruction of its proper functions. As the great Mexican Nobel laureate Octavio Paz wrote, the market is an efficient mechanism, but like all mechanisms, it is blind. It creates abundance and misery with the same indifference. Left to its own course, the market threatens the ecological balance of the planet, pollutes the air, poisons the water, makes deserts of forests, and in the end, harms many living species, among them man himself. Last and most importantly, the market is not and cannot be a model for life. It is not an ethic, but rather only a method of production and consumption. It ignores fraternity, destroys social ties, imposes uniformity of conscience, and has turned art and literature into commerce. There is not, in what I have just said, the least nostalgia for state-idolatry. The state does not create wealth. Many of us ask ourselves, is there no remedy for this situation? And if there is, what is it? I would be lying if I said that I knew the answer. No one knows it. Our century will end with an immense interrogation. What can we do? As writers, we can offer our testimony, saying what we truly feel and think is the first step toward the answer. End of the quote. The market could hardly fulfill Latin America's need to redistribute wealth, battle poverty, achieve social integration, and invest in human capital and infrastructure. We have arrived then at a truth that should have never been controversial, that the functions of the state and of the market are complementary and not contradictory. The ideas I have proposed thus far are neither simple nor without controversy. However, I am convinced of their importance. Whichever course we choose to implement, we must always be conscious of the need to confront decisively and responsibly the issues of poverty and inequality. This is a duty grounded primarily in an ethical imperative, but it also has a political dimension. I must ask you, how much poverty can democracy tolerate? How much poverty can democracy endure? This is not merely a rhetorical question. In fact, the enthusiasm with which democratically elected governments were greeted in the 1980s has gradually faded throughout the region. Weakened by uncontrolled levels of social violence and apathy, Latin American democracies, both old and new alike, now face a daily struggle to keep themselves afloat. As Latin Americans, and particularly as Central Americans, we have discovered that the cessation of war has not meant the end to violence in our societies. It grows clearer with every passing day that there is a growing contradiction between a system that creates needs in its peoples and then denies them the means by which to satisfy them. This very contradiction has resulted in a rising rate of delinquency. My people's disenchantment with their political system is as much a result of government's disinterest in combating increasing poverty as it is a reflection of the corruption and cynicism that threaten democracy on a daily basis. Corruption not only consists in using political power for unlawful personal gain. Corruption is much more than a collusion between public servants and businessmen, or between public servants and criminals to reap illegal and morally dubious benefits. There are other kinds of corruption that are not always subject to legal sanctions and public scrutiny. For example, Corruption is when those who govern a democracy fail to exercise their duty to educate the masses. Corruption is when our leaders, in order to get elected, tell people only what they want to hear and not what they must listen, what they must know. Furthermore, it is corrupt to forget that taking part in politics or in government requires preparation, unselfishness, a desire to serve and a determination to practice what you preach. Such practices corrupt and degrade not only individuals and societies, but the entire democratic system. Latin America has continuously suffered from the effects of corruption. Thus, it is not surprising that our political systems are sorely hampered by a lack of credibility. With few exceptions, the political elite of Latin America continue to disregard basic democratic principles and norms and continue to flood the system with their demagoguery. This particular evil, however, does not just afflict Latin America or emerging democracies. It is to be found in the established democracies as well. For example, the President of the United States approved legislation to enforce a unilateral economic embargo in which he did not believe, merely in order to satisfy certain voting blocs. Such decisions undermine democracy and make of it a victim of woeful opportunism. The recent political crisis in Ecuador, not so recent now, is a disturbingly clear example of the destructive effects of demagoguery. The events in Ecuador must have struck observers in developed democratic states like a poorly written scene in a comedic play. However, for us Latin Americans, this study serves as an extremely sad reminder of the fragility of democratic institutions in many parts of our region. It also showed dramatically that both our people and our politicians continue to misunderstand the underlying ethic of democracy. It was particularly disheartening to observe how quickly Ecuadorian politicians were ready to hand over their responsibilities to the army in order to resolve the crisis. Once again, the politicians legitimized the distorted and disastrous role that armies have played in Latin America as the guardians of governmental institutions. Despite nearly a century and a half of caudillismo, innumerable coup d'etats and brutal waves of repression, Latin Americans still do not seem to have learned how to put their armed forces in their proper place. Far from being bastions serving to protect democratic institutions, the armies of Latin America are a parasite on the body politic, sucking the life out of its democratic institutions. Armies in Latin America are dangerously powerful states within the state that have always been a hindrance to the real democratic development in our nations. In 1948, José Figueres, the president of Costa Rica, had the wisdom to understand this fundamental truth and abolish my country's army. History has confirmed the rightness of his decision, as it undoubtedly will also for the leaders of Haiti and Panama, who recently chose to follow the path of demilitarization by eliminating their armed forces. My efforts to reduce military spending to the greatest extent possible in developing countries and to encourage those countries to use more of the resources in social services are obviously based on my own personal ethics. However, my convictions are also based on the evidence of another quite irrefutable lesson that history has taught us: education's essential role in furthering the progress of nations. As long as Latin American societies remain unwilling to invest massively in their people's education, they will continue to be inextricably entangled in economic underdevelopment and social disintegration. By now, there is a consensus that educational levels are the most influential variable for the economic prosperity of individuals and nations. Likewise, The disparity of educational opportunities is the most important factor in fostering social inequalities. In Latin America, we have squandered whole generations while we discuss in exasperating detail the possible merits and demerits of different development strategies. Yet we continually refrain from spending the resources and exerting the efforts that are necessary for economic well-being. Education is indispensable if we are to consolidate democracy. Through education, faceless masses will become individualized, responsible citizens. Through education, we will discard once and for all that false belief that has haunted Latin America ever since the early days of our independence, namely, the idea that it is possible to create republics without establishing a culture of democracy. Education is necessary so that every Latin American can creatively contribute to the progress of their society. Education is imperative in preventing our people from being prey to the deceptive words of demagogues and despots by teaching them their rights and civic responsibilities. Above all, our future depends on the will of Latin Americans to embark on this educational crusade. Moreover, Latin America's leaders must be willing to dedicate their resources toward this endeavor. In order to live up to this task, it will be necessary for politicians to have the courage to make controversial decisions, including enacting a tax reform, promoting increased levels of savings, and reducing military spending. All this is possible if our leaders can envision a future past the next election. Now, more than ever, Latin American politicians must understand that to govern is to educate. Latin America can learn much from its own history. However, there are also lessons to be learned by its relations with the developed world. Obviously, it is not my place to tell heads of state how they should handle their foreign policy. On the other hand, as a Latin American, I do have the right and the responsibility to point out what seemed to me to be gross errors in those policies. In particular, I would like to draw your attention to current policy decisions that are being made in the United States that will invariably have serious consequences for Latin America. Currently, Latin Americans are worried about the possibility that the United States lift its ban on supplying high-technology planes to the region. Preliminary negotiations for the sale of a significant number of F-16 fighters to Chile at a unitary cost of over $24 million have been approved already. Eliminating the restrictions that President Jimmy Carter adopted with great vision and courage during his presidency would result in the beginning of a tragic arms race in South America. Tragic, not only because the almost non-existent possibility that international conflict erupt in the region has now reappeared, but also because it would inevitably signify an increase in poverty and the deterioration of living conditions for the majority of Latin Americans. If buying conventional weapons already represents an excessive burden on national budgets for all the developing world, there can be no doubt that high-technology weapons would extract a much larger sacrifice at the expense of Latin America's people. The countries of Latin America and the Caribbean should accept a moratorium of 2 years before deciding to acquire high-technology weapons. During this period, they would negotiate a permanent agreement on the prohibition of acquiring such weapons. Moreover, the adoption of such an accord would not impede continuing efforts to write and adopt ethic codes of a national, regional, and international scale on the transfer of arms. I believe that you have an important role in demanding that your leaders support these initiatives. The time has come to make human beings more important than arms. Friends, there are no easy answers to the challenges that currently face Latin America. In fact, the very magnitude of these challenges reveal the complex nature of what is at stake. We must ask ourselves for more than a different strategy of economic growth or a revision of political institutions. Our true dilemma lies in the sphere of values. Latin Americans must realize that it is necessary to build rational, compassionate, and just societies that will afford every human being a dignified place among men. Latin Americans must adopt a new ethics. These ethics need not be invented from scratch, as its foundation is implicit in the political, philosophical, and religious ideas of our history. We must seek guidance both in those ethical ideas that have already been implemented and those that have merely been advocated. These principles are carved on the facades of numerous houses of parliament, government palaces, churches, and universities. They are engraved on catacombs, dungeons, and prison cells. Jesus, Plato, Moses, Mohammed, Buddha, the anonymous authors of Popol Vuh, St. Thomas, Rousseau, Locke, Kant, Adam Smith, and Marx, the fathers of the American Revolution, Latin America's Bolivar, San Martin, José Cecilio del Valle, Florencio del Castillo, Sarmiento, Juárez, and José Martí. In this century, Gandhi, Churchill, Keynes, Martin Luther King, Hayek, Popper, Isaiah Berlin, and Mother Teresa of Calcutta. These are merely some of the names of people whose ideas have been incorporated into the Latin American intellectual pantheon. The ethics that Latin America deserves to have comprises precepts such as Plato's The Virtue of the State, Moses' commandment not to kill, Jesus' advice to love thy neighbor as thyself, Gandhi's warning to never respond with violence, and ending with Mandela and Menchu's reminder that we are all created equal. Latin America has the possibility to establish their ethics on all of these values because in our region, as in no other, different races, languages, religions, virtues, vices, joys, and sufferings from all corners of the world have met and mingled. This ethical system, assembled from sacred values expounded by people from all eras and all parts of the world, may in practice lead ultimately to greater solidarity, tolerance, respect for life, human liberty, and dignity. One of the most profound thinkers of Latin America, the Dominican Pedro Enriquez Ureña, spoke long ago of the historical importance of the challenges facing us. He said, if our region is to be nothing more than an extension of Europe, if the only thing we do is to provide more territory for the exploitation of man by man, if we do not decide to make this a promised land for all humanity, weary of seeking vainly for it elsewhere, there is no point to our lives. End of the quote. It is time to discover a sense of who we are in Latin America. We set out in this search for identity over two centuries ago, filled with a hope that still has not grown dim today. Thank you very much.
Now we're going to open the floor for questions from the audience. Professor Philip will be the chair, so we'll monitor all the questions.
Okay, thank you. Okay, who wishes to start proceedings? Sometimes a 10-second silence while somebody thinks of what they want to say. Ah, there isn't this time. Okay. Professor Desai.
Not being from Latin America, but being from Asia, I wonder whether one of Latin America's problems was premature independence. Because when Asia and Africa went to colonialism, they came out of it, a much better democratic tradition. Was Latin America's problem premature independence?
No, I don't believe so. I don't think it has anything to do with. No. Well, we might have not had a Thomas Jefferson in Latin America to bring it together and keep it together, you know. But we never learned the lessons of history, never did the right things, economically speaking. Never had the courage, determination, and vision to do what was necessary since the early days of independence. And the underlying corruption that has prevailed since the early 19th century has been one of the main factors in, you know, not succeeding fighting underdevelopment and poverty.
Okay, Alfredo at the back, and then.
Mr. President, you're speaking a lot about Latin America, but again, Mexico is a member of NAFTA. Cuba is sanctioned by the Hans-Bertrand Act. Isn't it maybe time for Latin American countries to forget about this notion of Latin America and accept the fact that the United States is the hegemonic power on the continent and aspire to membership of NAFTA?
I'm sorry, Anas?
And aspire to membership of NAFTA.
And its part?
And seek membership of NAFTA.
For the Latin American countries?
Yeah.
Well, that's precise. But that's precisely what we are looking for and fighting for. You know, the Miami Summit of 1994 agreed, the presidents, the heads of state agreed that by the year 2005 they would have they should have reached at least an agreement in order to fulfill our dream of free trade by the year 2010, 2012, something like that. But it seems to me that in the last election, Buchanan scared, or I should say Ross Perot scared Buchanan, and Buchanan scared Bob Dole, and Bob Dole scared Bill Clinton, and nobody wants now fast track for Chile, who has been applying to join NAFTA for many, many, many years, and Chile has done, in a way, its homework, and is ready and prepared to join it if there is any will in the United States, in the U.S. Congress. And now that President Clinton visited Mexico and Costa Rica and met with all the Central American presidents and in Barbados with the all the Caribbean heads of state, again, all we asked was, we want to join NAFTA. We are ready. So it doesn't depend on us now. The ball is in the U.S. court.
Okay.
wherever they are in the world without any political problems. What do you see as the future within Latin America for your proposal to have a total ban in the region? If Chile fails for its own protection, do you think it's to buy these weapons?
Well, my answer to your question is not going to be a short one, unfortunately. I want to tell you that since I stepped down from office in 1990, well, with the proceeds of the Nobel Peace Prize established a foundation, the Arias Foundation for Peace and Human Progress, and I've been trying to demilitarize the region, the whole region. 10 years ago, the 5 Central American presidents signed the peace plan that I introduced. I dream of making Central America the first demilitarized zone in the world. It hasn't been possible, but there's no other region in the world which has cut military spending more drastically than Central America and as a whole Latin America. We spend 1.6% of GDP on defense, about twice what sub-Saharan Africa spends. We were able to reduce significantly the size of the armed forces in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and more recently in Guatemala. I was able to persuade the Panamanian government to get rid of the armed forces, and constitutionally, the army was abolished. In Panama in 1994, and in Haiti in 1995. So it seems to me, since I've been involved in persuading governments to cut even more the military spending, that it would be a great mistake for Chile to start a new arms race in the Southern Cone by buying high technology weapons, which have been banned since 1977 when Jimmy Carter introduced this ban. The United States is the only military superpower, the only economic superpower, but unfortunately doesn't want to become a moral superpower. Already it is exporting about 70% of the arms being bought by the developing world. And I think it's time for Washington, if they want to be the only superpower on this planet, to put principles before profits. And as I put it here, to make human beings, people, more important than arms. So let me finish then. It is known to everybody that if Chile buys these planes, Argentina will buy some, Brazil will buy some, Colombia will buy some, Peru will buy some, and eventually even Ecuador will have to buy some. To your question, if the U.S. doesn't sell them, another country is going to sell them. That's why I have introduced only 10 days ago in New York, along with some other Nobel laureates, you know, I established a commission 18 months ago, a commission of Nobel laureates with 14 Nobel laureates, peace Nobel laureates, to draft a code of conduct on arms transfers, international code of conduct, to be adopted by all the countries of the world. This is an idea whose time has not come, but we need to push it and we need to move forward because I hope this could be implemented by the year 2000 or before the year 2000. Because every time you ask government officials in Washington, they tell you, if I don't sell, France is going to sell them, Britain is going to sell them, China is going to sell them, Russia is going to sell them. You are aware that more than 92 or 93% of the arms being sold today are being sold by the 5 permanent members of the Security Council. So my only answer to them is, what would you tell a Colombian if you ask him not to sell drugs to us. And if he replies to you, if he responds to you, if I don't sell the drugs to the U.S., Peru will, Bolivia will, Myanmar will, Indonesia will. So there's no answer to that except to adopt an international code of conduct on arms transfers. Let me make a parallel between the sale of drugs and the sale of arms. For the United States, and this is true for most industrialized countries, the way to fight drug trafficking is by looking at the producers of drugs, not at the demand. While concerning arms, they look at the demand, not at the producers. There is a double standard here because both drugs and arms kill young people. The fact that one is legal and the other is not doesn't make any difference. We could legalize drugs tomorrow if we want to. Then concerning this legislation, I keep telling my friends in Washington, who certifies the certificator? Why is it that you have become so arrogant that you want to tell the people of the entire world who is doing good and who is doing evil? Well, it is a fact of life that the U.S. Senate, the U.S. Congress is just like the Roman Senate 2,000 years ago. You know, they want to legislate for the entire world. They want to tell you, you cannot sell arms to Iran or to Libya, or you cannot do this, you can do this, and you cannot do it. You know. So I think that it is a very, this bill is for us totally unacceptable. Having said that, no one is going to change it. We have to live with it. Jesse Helms is not going to allow any changes to that legislation. And Bill Clinton is not going to do anything. Well, I pointed out some, not solutions, but from what I just said, it is implicit that it is also the responsibility of the electors to open their eyes and to choose the right people to office. I think it's not enough to blame only the governors, only the rulers, those that we have elected. Indeed, there is a need for a new ethics, as I pointed out. You can introduce all the controls you want, but the more democratic these countries become, the less corrupt they will also become. You can be sure that the less open a society is, the more authoritarian a political system is, the more corrupt it is also. So it seems to me that the difference between corruption in Uruguay, corruption in Costa Rica, and corruption in Mexico is the fact that our political systems are much more open, our societies are much more open. We indeed have individual liberties which are respected by everybody, freedom of the press being one of them, essential to any democracy. This is not the case in some of the most authoritarian regimes in Latin America. And I think that we also need to pay more attention to reaffirming certain values in our families. I think education should play a very important role. Unfortunately, we bend too frequently our principles and our values until they break. And again, as I pointed out, there are corruptees and corruptors. I mean, the private sector has played a very destructive role, trying to bribe everybody, trying to corrupt everybody in the public sector, government officials. I think one of the greatest problems we have is our impunity. So I wish I could give you a more specific answer, but I don't have it.
Yes? As we see the implementation of structural adjustment programs all throughout Latin America and the trendy aspiration to follow El Modelo Chileno, what do you see in the future of the recent and fragile democracies of Latin America?
Well, I am in favor of getting rid of all the distortions that still prevail in our economies. In my own country, I don't think the Costa Rican people deserve 3 years of stagnant economy simply because we are not doing the homework. Simply because we don't want to get rid of our fiscal deficit, 5% of GDP. Simply because we have a huge, inefficient public sector, and we don't want to privatize anything. Simply because we still have a monopoly, 1997, at the end of the millennium, of the financial system, of the financial sector. Can you imagine Lord Desai? The state banks, they are responsible for interest rates of 24% for agriculture and industry and housing. Who can build a house? How can you build a low-cost house to a poor family at a rate of 24%? Still, we don't do anything to get rid of that. So, according to the World Bank, we need to grow at least at a rate of 3.5% in order to start alleviating poverty. Costa Rica has been growing the last 3 years at a rate of 2.5 to 3% per capita wise, no growth, zero growth. And this is true for many other countries. Now, we can't depend on any foreign aid anymore. Direct foreign investment is not going to help much, at least to most of the countries in Latin America, because direct foreign investment, as we all know, goes mainly to 12 countries in the developing world, and two-thirds of direct foreign investment goes to industrialized nations anyway. And in developing world, China gets 40%, and sub-Saharan Africa gets 2%. And in Latin America, Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, and Chile get some direct foreign investment, but Haiti doesn't get a penny. Nicaragua doesn't get a penny. So the poorest countries cannot rely on direct foreign investment. So we need to cut military expenditures and free resources to invest in education. There is one final thought that I would like to add. We are not spending less on education than some Asian countries, East Asian countries, but we spend in public education in a different way. While in East Asia, the emphasis is in kindergarten education, primary education, and secondary education. Our emphasis is in higher education. So you find that in Latin America, in Venezuela, or Argentina, or Uruguay, 40% of the public budget for education goes to the universities. And it's free education. So we are subsidizing the middle classes and the wealthy. And we are condemning to illiteracy our young children. In a country like Guatemala or Peru, perhaps half of the kids between 6 and 12 years go to primary, attend schools, primary schools. And even in our country, Costa Rica, 45% of our children from 13 to 16 are not attending high school. So if that is the case in Costa Rica, you can imagine how it is then in Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Haiti. So we should be spending at least 5% of our GDP on education in the next 10 years. Otherwise, we'll be a continent of peones in the 21st century, as we've been a continent of peones in the 20th century. Well, concerning Cuba, I'm sure Fidel Castro is going to die with his boots on. Nothing is going to happen. And I feel very sad about it because I don't think the Cuban people deserve so much punishment. Punishment from the United States, punishment from Fidel Castro. If he were less arrogant, more humble, he would have accepted long time ago that his experiment is wrong, was wrong since the very beginning. But he doesn't know what humility is. Concerning the role of Europe in Latin America, all I could tell you is that industrialized nations are just too selfish nowadays. There is very little solidarity with the developing world, much more in the United States than in Europe. Look at foreign aid. The U.S. is spending on foreign aid 0.1% of GDP, one-ninth of what Nordic countries spend. Just one-ninth. The Japanese spend more in absolute figures. The Germans also, the French also. The U.S. comes number four. And the reason why President Clinton visited Central America and Latin America recently is because he wants to extend the U.S. markets and because Latin America has become the main importer of U.S. goods. That's precisely what he said to the American people while he was visiting Latin America. When Mexico paid its debt recently, what he said on television, because I saw him, I know what I'm saying is true, because if anyone had told me that he had said what he said, I couldn't believe he said such a silly thing. But he said to the ambassador when he was making a speech, announcing that Mexico was ready to pay back in advance the loans from Washington. He said, well, I am very grateful, I thank you. I want to tell the American people that this has been a very good business for us. We made $500 million in profits. So I was right. We made $500 million in profits. So if that is the attitude that prevails in Washington, what can we expect? So all I could tell you is it is immoral to keep selling arms to the developing countries. And I hope Tony Blair keeps his promise to implement what he introduced in his manifesto, to curtail the export of arms to dictators, to violators of human rights, to countries which are engaged in armed aggression against other peoples, other nations, to countries which sponsor terrorism. But this lack of consistency and this cynicism and hypocrisy, you know, that has prevailed in the past, I don't know if it is going to change. The industrialized countries talk about human rights with China or with Cuba, but not with Saudi Arabia. And they don't sell arms to dictators. They claim they don't sell arms to dictators if the dictator is Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi, but not if the dictator is the ruler in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. On the other hand, I believe we in the developing world need to cut military spending and free resources for education and health. I think it's immoral to keep selling arms to sub-Saharan Africa. I've been asking the industrialized countries to stop sending arms to sub-Saharan Africa. This is a continent which is disintegrating, and no one cares. You sometimes watch on television what is happening in Zaire or Rwanda, and you simply change the channel or turn the page and forget about it. So I think it's our own responsibility to learn that to govern is to choose, and we need to choose between educating our children or buying tanks and gunfighters and jet fighters. All I could tell you is that our children and the children in Pakistan, and the children in Asia, and the children in India, and the children in Somalia and Angola, what they want, and not only what they want, what they need is schools and not jet fighters. The difference between a statesman and a political leader is that the political leader will tell the people what they want. The statesman will tell the people what they need. So we need more statements in today's world. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you, thank Dr. Arias for being here this evening, and all of you. And as this is our last event for this academic year, I hope you join us next year as the Latin American Circle will continue to promote Latin American issues at the school. And once again, thank you and have a good evening.